In chapter 25, you would have noticed that the speech of Bildad was exceedingly short, and it basically consisted of nothing more than a very pompous, contrived declamation on the glory of God. It's almost as if the friends have run out of ideas, run out of energy to keep arguing with Job. And to his credit, Job has not buckled under the pressure, internal pressure of his psychological concerns, his emotional distress, his physical ailments and distress. He has not buckled under the barrage of criticism from his friends. And behind it all, we must recall the manipulations of Satan and admire Job for his ability to have withstood all this, even though at times he has weakened and has appeared to be critical of God. He's always corrected himself. If you recall what has been stated, he's always somehow by God's grace corrected himself and not lapsed into a false and dangerous attitude of sitting in judgment upon God. The point is, how long is this cycle of argument going to go on? And we will find that the very brevity of chapter 25 and the silence of the friends thereafter indicates that Job has effectively won the debate and he has stood his ground. This conclusion is reinforced by the unique way in which chapter 27 opens, which, by the way, is identical to the way in which chapter 29 opens. If you look at both chapters 27 and 29, you will find the opening phrase is exactly the same. Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, if you think back to the earlier cycles of speeches, you will find there is a definite structure to it. And what is that structure? It consists of statements, a body of statements by one party, and against that, or opposing that, another body of statements rebutting what has just been said. Or it could be a body of statements by one party, and balanced against that, a body of statements responding to what has been said. So either it is by way of statement response or statement rebuttal. And this pattern is really the signature of a debate. It's very unique to this kind of speech. We don't normally engage in debates in day-to-day conversation. Our day-to-day conversation has a very free-flowing structure, but not where debate is involved. It has a very definite structure, and this we can see in the three cycles of speeches. So clearly, if the debate is going to continue, we should see the same structural pattern in what one party says and the other party responds. But that completely disappears. After chapter 25, the friends fall silent. It is now Job alone speaking all the way up to the end of chapter 31. And then from chapter 32, Elihu, the younger man, not necessarily a friend of Job, he butts in with his piece, which will take us up to chapter 37, and then from 38 to 41, the center stage is taken by God himself. So if we are thinking of the signature of a debate, additional reasons to believe that the debate has ended with Job victorious is the way chapters 27 and 29 begin. Moreover, Job continued his parable. The fact that there is a repetition of this opening verse in chapter 29 tells us, or is one of the clues, that the debate has ended. And also the fact that the word continued his parable, the phrase continued his parable, is used. So keeping that in mind, we can look at chapter 27 and try to analyze it, which has been done for you on the whiteboard. There are basically four sections. Verses 1 through 6, we find Job reaffirming his innocence. And verses 7 through 10, Job utters several imprecations against his enemies. In the couplet, verses 11 and 12, Job appears to be intent on instructing his enemies so that they would not be continue in their foolish statements. And then he concludes chapter 27, verses 13 through 23, with a description of how God deals with the ungodly. So chapter 27, verses 1 through 6 first. You notice the opening verse has mentioned, moreover, Job continued his parable. So where is he continuing from? He is continuing from chapter 26. If you turn your page back, you will find chapter 26, verse 14. Lo, these are parts of his ways, God's ways. But how little a portion is heard of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? And so on. So that line of thought is now continued in chapter 27. Note the word parable. It's a very interesting word. The Hebrew root word is mashal, which actually has a wide spectrum of meaning. So we have to be careful which meaning we pick on. It is really governed by the context. To illustrate, I will give you some examples, but keep in mind the key idea in mashal. The key idea is a comparison or a contrast, as the case may be, between two things. So keep in mind the idea of a comparison or a contrast. If the comparison is intended to be derogatory to the one, then the intended meaning would be conveyed by the English expression byword. For example, Psalm 28 verse 1, I have become like those who go down to the pit. In other words, I have become a byword for those who are destroyed. Another example from Job itself, chapter 30 in verse 19, I have become like dust and ashes. So here again you see the comparison, which is in a derogatory sense. And Job 17 verse 6, he, that is God, has made me also a byword. That expression indicates something derogatory, a byword of the people. And aforetime, before that, I was as a tabret, something that is highly regarded and praised. So whether it is intended to be derogatory or otherwise, the comparison that is included in the word mashal, the idea that is included in the word mashal, that comparison is ultimately intended to be with oneself. So although at the outset you may be looking at a comparison between two things, the point of using the word mashal is to indicate that you are now prepared to go ahead and look at yourself in relation to the pair of items that has been compared. In other words, you are invited to look, to compare, and to learn. And the way you learn is to look at yourself in relation to what has been compared. Look, compare, and learn. That is not the only meaning of the word mashal, which is why I said it, one has to be a little careful which interpretation you pick. Here are examples of other usages of mashal. And these examples have to do with prophets who are commissioned by God to pronounce a mashal against Israel or in relation to Israel. Famous example, of course, is Balaam, Numbers 23 verse 7. And he, that is Balaam, the wicked prophet, took up his parable, that is the word mashal again, and said, Balak, the king of Moab, had brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob, and come, defy Israel. So here, the mashal is a parable announced or enunciated against Israel. Another such example is Isaiah chapter 14, verse 4. Thou, this is Jehovah commanding Isaiah, thou shalt take up this proverb, mashal again, against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor seized the golden city? Just a point to remember, these usages of mashal, parable, is not what we commonly think of. When we use the word parable, we are automatically tuned in to the parables of Jesus. That is yet another application of the term. But here are different applications. We are still on the subject of mashal in relation to pronouncements made relating to Israel. One more example, Micah chapter 2 verse 4. In that day shall one take up a parable, mashal, against you, and lament with a doleful lamentation and say, we be utterly spoiled. So even the word proverb can be used for mashal. And then, of course, there is a more common meaning of mashal, one that we are familiar with. It is a memorable statement which is intended to convey moral or ethical instruction. And it is in this category that we find the parables of Jesus. So bear in mind that mashal, which is rendered here in Job 27 as parable, actually has quite a wide spectrum of meaning, and you need to be careful how you understand it. Earlier I said that the basic idea of mashal is to invite comparison with yourself. Look, compare, learn. This highlights also the intent of the mashal, and that is to instruct. It is a didactic piece. It is intended to instruct. And in that sense, it is used in Proverbs very characteristically. For example, Proverbs chapter 1 verse 8, my son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother. And then Proverbs 1:19, so are the ways of everyone that is greedy of gain, which taketh away the life of the owners thereof. Here, from verse 8, through verse 19 of Proverbs chapter 1 is one lengthy mashal, one lengthy parable, understood in the sense of a moral instruction. So a mashal need not be a short statement as we understand it. It can be a pretty lengthy statement as in the case of Proverbs chapter 1. Now we have to put on our thinking cap. In the context of Job 27, which meaning would be applicable to the use of the word parable in Job 27. What is Job's parable all about? Is it a denunciation of Israel? Obviously not. He preceded Israel. Is it derogatory? Is it in the sense of a byword? No, not really. The most logical meaning would be Job's parable, Mashal, is in the spirit of a memorable statement that is intended to convey moral or ethical instruction. So here is a good example of how the meaning of a word can be determined from the context and from the usage of the word in other contexts. Verses 1 through 6, "Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, as God liveth, who hath taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who hath vexed my soul, all the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live." When you read these six verses, what comes across to you? They are all connected. There's a common theme there. But what is the structure of this section? Is it just a speech? Is it just a protest? There is, if you look carefully, a very definite structure to it. And the structure is hinted at by the way the section begins, not in verse 1, but in verse 2. As God liveth. Whenever this expression is used to introduce what is to be stated next, it indicates that what is going to follow is an oath, and not just any ordinary oath, but an oath of the most solemn kind, because the name of the one living and true God is being invoked. As God liveth, as God is my witness, the name of God is being invoked. Therefore, what is going to follow, the next few statements, constitute an oath, but a very solemn, the most solemn form of an oath. Therefore, when Job uses that structure to introduce his oath, he is deadly serious. What he is going to say immediately after that is to be taken with utmost seriousness. And what is he basically saying in those six verses? I am innocent, I know I am, I'm sure I am, and I will not let go of that no matter what you or the rest of the world may say to me. If you now look at verse 3, all the while my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, there are two facets to this verse. The first facet is this. Clearly, the fact that the breath that is in him and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, which by the way is synthetic parallelism, basically indicate that he is a creature who, by virtue of being created and having life from God, is therefore completely dependent upon God. In other words, Job is saying, the very breath of life in me comes from God and is sustained by God, which is the point of verse 3. So verses 2 and 3 go together. All the while my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. Not only was that Spirit of life infused into me at birth or at fertilization, if you want to look at it in such microscopic detail, the life that I have is also from that moment on sustained by God. The other aspect of verse 3 is, if you look at it, my breath is in me, the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. Does it ring a bell? Does it remind you of something else that happened in creation? And certainly, if you set your mind rolling back to Genesis chapter 2, isn't this the way in which God created Adam? Did Adam not become a living creature only after God breathed, whatever that means, but God breathed the breath of life into him? In other words, making the form of a human being was not enough. That human being was not yet energized. He was not yet a living creature. Something else had to happen to make it living. Everything else was perfectly in place, except that this form was not alive. And the way the Bible describes it for us to understand is God breathed the Spirit of life into that form. And the Bible tells us Adam became a living soul. The point is this: granted, it is speculation, but it is so reminiscent of the creation of Adam that we are led to wonder whether that creation account was actually handed down. And with the dispersion of peoples after the Tower of Babel, that creation story must have been carried on and passed down, so that by the time of Job, it was basically part of the consciousness of the human race. It may be so. There is no definite proof for it. As it stands literally, all it indicates is Job acknowledging that he is a creature, and by virtue of that fact, he is completely dependent upon God. Ironically, the same God who now seems to deny him the right to a fair hearing. That is what makes his trial so difficult. Remember, we are speaking about Job issuing an oath. Verse 4 constitutes the oath proper. How do we know that? It may not appear like an oath. After all, verse 4 reads the following way: my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. That to us in English sounds more like a statement or a declaration, not necessarily an oath. The problem is this: there in the Hebrew text, if you care to look at it in detail, there is a specific participle which has not been translated in the English translation, and there are good reasons why it is left untranslated. And that participle is the word im. Have I written it down? Yes, I have. That word im has the meaning of if not, whether, when, since. And in this particular context, im, which has not been translated in the English translation, has the meaning of may God do so to me, that is, may God curse me if I do something or I don't do something. The fact that in the Hebrew text, verse 4, the content of verse 4 is prefixed with the word im indicates that the rest of verse 4 is without doubt an oath, because the word im introduces the structure of an oath. May God curse me if. What is Job saying if you read the rest of verse 4? my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. If you now read that in the light of this understanding that it's really an oath, it would be read as follows. May God curse me if I ever speak wickedness or utter deceit. I suggest that that would be the proper way to read it when the oath structure comes through clearly. May God curse me if I speak wickedness or tell lies. What Job is saying, in other words, is he is declaring that he would never justify or advocate wickedness in any shape or form so long as he lives. And this oath in chapter 27 verse 4 is very important because it paves the way for what he is going to say in chapter 31. In chapter 31, you will find Job giving his final declaration, his final oath of innocence. And after that, it's no more Job speaking, because Elihu speaks and then God takes over. And Job has, by the end of chapter 31, he's done with whatever he has to say. His time is up, in other words. Therefore, chapter 27 verse 4 must be seen in the light of the fuller, more complete and final oath of innocence which Job is going to declare in chapter 31. In the section that we have read, there are actually two distinct oaths. The one is in verse 4. There is another oath, however, and that is in verse 5. God forbid that I should justify you. Here the oath structure is clearer because it begins with an expression which we already know is quite typical of an oath, of certain types of oaths. God forbid that I should justify you. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. God forbid that can also be read as far be it from me. In other words, far be it from me that I should justify you, I should agree with you, far be it from me to remove mine integrity from me. In other words, to confess that I haven't been what I have claimed to be. So this is also an oath, but it is a very specific kind of oath. The earlier oath is a more universal kind of oath. Job is, by making that first oath, Job is not saying that he is sinless. We must be very clear about this. He is merely saying that he is not guilty as he has been charged by his friends. He is not guilty in the sense that he does not, as far as human reasoning goes, he does not deserve the kind of afflictions that have come upon him. In other words, he is not harboring any kind of secret sin in him. Therefore, there appears to be no logical reason why God would send these afflictions upon him. They are definitely not a mark of judgment, as the friends were trying to maintain. This oath is a more specific kind of oath. The earlier oath, you remember, was grounded in God because it began by invoking the name of God. This second oath is a slightly different oath in the sense that it is related to what could happen to Job if what the friends said is true. So if you put these two oaths together, they amount to Job completely dismissing all the counsel that the three friends have given him. Now the next section, verses 7 through 10, Job's imprecations against his enemies. Bear in mind that as with the imprecatory Psalms, there is nothing personal, there is no desire for revenge here. It is really the imprecations are pronounced by Job in the interest of seeing justice done to him. So there is no motive of personal vengeance is not there at all. Verses 7 through 10. Let mine enemy be as the wicked, and he that riseth up against me as the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he hath gained, when God taketh away his soul? Will God hear his cry when trouble cometh upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God? There is another oath structure here actually, because it begins with, in verse 7, let mine enemy be as. Here, it's a different kind of an oath. What Job is saying is, let mine enemy be dealt with just as the wicked, the condemned wicked, are dealt with by God. In the case of the condemned wicked, we know that God will at some point intervene in their lives to spoil their lives. And should they then call out to God for mercy, God will shut his ears, because such people call upon God only to get out of the trouble that they are in, not because they desire to please God. How do we understand this? You and I for sure will sin. Even this morning when we got up and before we came to church, if we think carefully, can we say for sure that no unclean or impure thought, expression, sentiment, feeling ever came into our system? No gesture, deed that is untoward, unbecoming, or cruel, or heartless, thoughtless, we never did it. Even in a short space of time, God's children will sin. The issue is not trying to give them a magic formula that would cocoon or insulate them so that they are insulated from sin, from committing sin. The idea is to teach God's people what John wrote in his epistle. If we confess our sins, whenever, wherever we commit them, God is faithful and just not only to forgive us our sins, but to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So that should be the pattern of the believer's life. If that is the case, whenever we call upon God, God will hear, not because we are sinless, but because we have made it an integral part of our life to be open, frank, and honest before God, to examine ourselves daily. That is why, even though David sinned the double sin of adultery and murder, when he cried out to God for forgiveness, God opened his ears and heart to the cry of David and forgave him. If David had cried out to God for the same request, with the same request, but with the desire only to get out of that difficulty, God would not have answered him, and he would surely have been judged. So that is why God, when he spoils the lives of the wicked and they cry out to him for mercy, he will merely shut his ears, because he knows the heart of these people, that all they want is an escape route. They are not interested in getting out of the situation because they don't want it to happen again. They don't want to dishonor God again. Their intention or their motive is wrong. Such people, Job says, should be judged, and those who have come against him wrongfully when they ought to have known better, when the evidence was there that he was innocent and yet they continue to judge him wrongfully, let them be as these wicked who are dealt with by God in the manner described. That is what constitutes an imprecatory statement. In verses 11 and 12, this couplet, Job is determined to instruct his friend. I will teach you by the hand of God. That which is with the Almighty will I not conceal. Behold, all ye yourselves have seen it. Why then are ye thus altogether vain? Note the beginning expression, the hand of God. It is with the hand that we do most of our work anyway. So this expression, the hand of God, denotes all that God has done. I will teach you by the hand of God. What are we getting into? We've said that hand of God is an expression to be understood as denoting whatever God has done. Question is, what has God done? And for that, the most succinct answer is to be found in the Shorter Catechism. God's works are the works of creation and providence. These are the two categories of his work, so to speak. Therefore, what Job is going to say is, if he is going to use the God's works of creation and providence to instruct his friends, he doesn't need to go beyond that. He's not going to call for unusual revelation. What God has already done in his works of creation and providence is enough to demonstrate the reality of God, that God is a God of justice, and that God will not let sin go unpunished. You don't need to go beyond that. Verse 12 points out that Job's friends have seen this handiwork of God. After all, God's works in creation and in providence are not secret. They are not withheld. There's nothing concealed. They are in the open. If only we have eyes to see and ears to hear, the evidence of God's works of creation and providence are crying out in clear and unmistakable tones. There's nothing concealed about it. So why are the friends talking the way they have? Why are they giving counsel, Job says? Why are you, my friends, giving counsel which is futile? It is futile, it is irrelevant, your counsel, because you haven't bothered to take note of the way God operates. If you did, you wouldn't talk to me in this way. That's what Job says to his friends. In particular, Job says, if you have correctly understood the way God operates in creation and in providence, you would not continue to maintain that any time a person has sudden and severe affliction coming upon him, that is immediately to be taken as God's judgment. That is not true. That is the point Job has been making in all of his rebuttals. That we may not understand why an innocent believer may have to suffer such terrible afflictions and humiliation. But it is a gross mistake to take the externals in this case being mental, emotional, physical suffering, material loss, and equate that with secret sin, because that is not the way God works. God's ways ultimately, Job says, are inscrutable. Therefore, when an upright, honest, God-fearing person suffers terrible affliction, instead of jumping to the silly conclusion that that person is harboring secret sin, we have to recognize that we are yet again brought face to face with the fact that God's ways are inscrutable, And no man may say to God, what doest thou? In other words, God at all times, in all situations, is absolutely sovereign. Just because you and I are believers does not mean that God would diminish his sovereignty just to make us happy or just to make life comfortable for us. That doesn't work, because God will not allow his sovereignty or anything that is intrinsic to him to be in any way diminished or compromised by whatever he may want to do for us. Yes, God loves his children, for sure. Why else would he have sent the only begotten Son to die for our sin? But loving us doesn't mean diminishing his sovereignty in order to make us comfortable and happy. And in any case, this world, this earthly life, is not our permanent abode. So why are you and I complaining when we have to suffer affliction? Yes, it is not pleasant, it is not easy, but there is no basis for us, and Job has come to this point already, there is no basis for any believer to challenge God or to expect God to justify his ways to man. That doesn't work at all. Then verses 13 through 23, the final section of chapter 27, how does God deal with the ungodly? This is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage of oppressors which they shall receive of the Almighty. If his children be multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those that remain of him shall be buried in death, and his widows shall not weep, though he heap up silver as the dust and prepare raiment as the clay. He may prepare it, but the just shall put it on, and the innocent shall divide the silver. He buildeth his house as a moth, and as a booth that the keeper maketh. The rich man shall lie down, but he shall not be gathered. He openeth his eyes, he is not. Terrors take hold upon him as waters. A tempest stealeth him away in the night. The east wind carrieth him away, and he departeth, and as a storm hurleth him out of his place. For God shall cast upon him and not spare. He would fain flee out of his God's hand. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. You need to be aware, if you do look at commentaries from time to time, that this entire section, verses 13 through 23, is ascribed by some commentators not to Job, but amazingly to Bildad, and they would want to relocate this section, verses 13 through 23, back to chapter 25, which is Bildad's speech. Part of the reason for their reconstruction is that they claim that Bildad's speech in chapter 25 is too short. That's their opinion. So they claim, because they think it is too short, there must be some verses missing. And then they jump on this section, verses 13 to 23, and they say this is more in line with the type of counsel the friends would give than with anything that Job would say. Therefore, we believe this should be removed from chapter 27 and tagged on to the end of chapter 25, and that would give the balance. I say this because some of you may be taken aback, even confused by such reconstructions or attempted reconstructions. Please bear in mind that ultimately we have to go back to the manuscripts. And there is no manuscript support in any surviving Hebrew manuscript for supposing that verses had been missing from chapter 25, still less that this entire section should be cut out and tagged on to Bildad's speech. It is highly speculative with no manuscript support. If you look at it objectively, it fits in with all that Job has been saying all along. There is no basis, no logical basis for suddenly ascribing this to Bildad and supposing that it is more in keeping with the temper of Bildad than with Job. That is a totally speculative approach which we cannot agree to. The lines as I have read them to you are generally clear. We won't go into them on a line by line basis. However, there are three specific verses that would do with some clarification. Verse 18, he buildeth his house. This is in reference to the wicked, ungodly rich who accumulate their wealth by unlawful means. He buildeth his house as a moth and as a booth that the keeper maketh. The nest made by the moth is of course very fragile. What is this booth that the keeper maketh? It is a temporary shelter, what we would call a lean-to, that is hastily erected by the night watchman typically in the vineyard when the grapes are about to ripen. So it is by no means intended as a permanent dwelling. It's only for that seasoning of the ripening of the grapes that the night watchman needs a place of shelter. So that is what is in mind when the text refers to the booth that the keeper maketh. What the point of this analogy is, the dwelling, even if it may be built in a palatial way, the dwelling of the ungodly is as fragile as the nest of a moth or lean-to shed constructed by the keeper of the vineyard while he is on watch during the night. Verse 19, the rich man shall lie down, but he shall not be gathered. He openeth his eyes, and he is not. This expression, shall lie down, in this particular context, means simply shall die. The rich man shall die. But then what is this shall not be gathered? It means basically shall not have an honorable burial. The best way to understand this is to look at a comparable usage, Genesis 25 verse 8. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. So clearly Abraham was given an honorable burial and mourned for the requisite number of days, 30 days or whatever days the people, his family and servants mourned for him. But the wicked, the ungodly rich, they shall die and they shall not receive an honorable burial. In some ways, the quality of your life, you may not agree with me, but in some ways the quality of your life can be gauged by how many people really miss you when you die. It's a very interesting thought. You ask yourself, if I were really to die suddenly, I don't think many people would miss me, to be very frank. But there are others, and Reverend Toh was certainly one of them, without question. His departure meant a great loss to all of us. But all of us desire, whether or not it's actually accomplished, all of us desire that our friends and our loved ones gather around us and bury us. And that is why it is customary for each one who is close to the departed person, after the coffin is lowered, to take a clump of earth and throw it on the coffin. It is a way of signifying one's identity, one's link with the departed person. So that, even for the wicked, that is their desire. They have lived well materially. They want to die well. They want a grand and honorable burial with thousands of mourners. But Job says that more often than not, they may be rich, they may have lived well, but they will not die well. And the third verse that needs explanation is verse 21. The east wind carrieth him away and he departeth. Again, it is referring to the ungodly rich person. And as a storm, this east wind hurleth him out of his place. Be aware that in the book of Job, violent storms are generally represented as coming from the east. Such a whirlwind, says Job, would unceremoniously carry away the life of a godless rich man, a point which is indicated by the parallelism of the second half of this verse. And as a storm, this east wind hurleth him, the ungodly rich person, out of his place. What is interesting as we come to the end of this chapter is this. Job has a lot of cutting, stinging remarks to make in this chapter. What stands out, however, in this chapter is the total silence of the friend. The silence of the friend speaks louder than Job. It's very curious. Why have these people suddenly fallen silent? Which again lends support to my thesis that they have basically given up and indicated their defeat in this debate with Job. Indeed, their silence indicates that Job has completely refuted their claim. What claim? The claim that any time a person has a sudden onset of affliction upon him, that immediately can be taken as a signal of secret sin. And Job says that is not so, that is not the way God works. And he has, by the end of this chapter, proven that point. That is why they have nothing further to say. Chapter 28 is a digression in praise of wisdom, and we will consider that, God willing, next week.